hear argument next in Bagus versus Moss, Appeal 1049.
I may your honors, I need a glass of water.
Certainly.
May I approach?
Yes, please. So, I'd like to hear your argument as soon as you're ready. Good morning, welcome to the court.
Good morning, your honors. Thank you very much for permitting me to appear here on behalf of my client, Mr. Benches, this morning. The fundamental issue before this court is, when did Mr. Benches' case against Mr. Moss and his firm actually accrue?
Under New York law.
Under New York law.
But we're under some other law.
Before you get to that, let me ask you a question. Is there any doubt whether this court, rather than the Second Circuit, has jurisdiction over this appeal? How does your claim involve interpretation and application of patent law? That's what I don't quite understand. I have some ideas about it, but I wonder if you could tell me that, because I take it there's nothing you can look to in the patent laws that says what kind of an inquiry a law firm should make before it tells a client that they think he has a patentable invention.
Your Honor, we asked ourselves the very same question. That's one of the reasons why the case was initially filed with the Second Circuit. However, the statutes of the United States, 28 U.S.C. Section 1338, which talks about jurisdiction of the courts, and specifically the courts of appeals, specifically says that any case that even remotely deals with the question of patents should be properly turned over to the Federal Circuit. When I did file my initial appeal, it was filed in the Second Circuit. Counsel from the other side and I then conferred, investigated together the statutes, and we both agreed that under the circumstances, because the underlying issues, if this case was in fact to be reversed and returned to the district court in the Southern District of New York, has to do with whether a patent was valid and enforceable. And so under that theory, we're here before you.
I don't think it's quite right to say the issue is the validity of the patent. The patent's already been adjudicated to be invalid. The issue seems to be whether a prior art search was made that was up to the standards of prior art searching. And it's not so clear that the nature or extent of a prior art search requires answering a substantial question of patent law as opposed to ordinary due diligence law.
But your honors, this is considered the expert court in issues of patent law, and who better than this court as an expert court in the areas of patent to decide what the due diligence
We don't have the ability to say we're more expert, therefore we have jurisdiction. We only have jurisdiction if resolving this case requires us to answer a substantial question of patent law. So what is the substantial question of patent law as opposed to due diligence law that we would necessarily have to answer to resolve this appeal?
At this time, there is no substantial question of patent law. The question simply is whether, in fact, a cause of action for legal malpractice accrued in December of 2007, or did it accrue in September of 2007?
That's a state law issue, isn't it?
I understand, Your Honor.
So it doesn't arise or implicate the patent laws at that point.
With a strict interpretation of the statutes relating to the jurisdiction of this court in connection with patent issues, it was our interpretation, both mine and counsel for the appellee, that we'd rather bring it here because even remotely, it involves a question of patent law.
Well, the parties can't give us jurisdiction.
I understand.
Over a matter, we have no jurisdiction. So whether you agree with the other side that the case should be here, you still have to establish the fact that we have jurisdiction over the issue. And on what basis is that jurisdiction law?
On the basis that the underlying issues involve a question of patent law.
What question? You say it involved, the underlying issue involved a question of patent law. My answer is, what question of patent law? Let me suggest to you one possible answer might be the question of what is comparable art, comparable prior art. Now, I don't know, the two patents that were found later on, did they involve cosmetic containers or other containers?
Cosmetic containers, no.
They involve cosmetic containers.
Yes. Yes.
But there still might be a question of whether the prior art involved something that was comparable to cosmetic containers. I suppose if you discovered the prior art in some sort of suitcase, you might say, well, that nobody expected them to do. Your argument, as I understand it, is that they didn't make an adequate search. Is that correct?
That is correct. That if they had in fact engaged in the due diligence, even basic due diligence, in connection with the patent search, they would have found these two particular patents that eventually were cited against.
One of them was a Swiss patent, wasn't it?
I'm sorry?
One of them was a Swiss patent.
Yes, Your Honor, but we have access.
Does an American firm conducting a patent search have to search Swiss patents?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely, because...
They have to search, I assume, Japanese patents.
Absolutely, certainly my law firm does, absolutely. If 35 U.S.C. Section 102A and B talk about anywhere that prior art that exists out there more than 1 year prior to the filing of an application published anywhere in the world, there is a duty to go out there and find it, because exactly this might happen at some future date after the client has incurred tremendous amount of cost and expense in going to a law firm, securing the firm, relying on their opinion, relying on the patent search results, engaging in all the things that inventors normally do to bring a product to market.
But doesn't that really depend on the relationship between a client and the law firm as to the extent of the prior art search which is undertaken? The client can request a worldwide search and pay for it. He can request a U.S. search. We can request a search of certain only other European countries or otherwise. So that's an agreement between the client and the firm. And it's not just done undertaken completely, because a worldwide search is rather expensive. And some clients don't like the idea of spending that kind of money for lawyers.
But, Your Honor, only if the attorney actually recommends and says to the client, listen, this is the situation. Your patent might be declared invalid and unenforceable in a court of law. That's certainly our practice in our law firm. When a client comes in and says, I want to file for a patent, I want to secure a patent, I point out that the validity of the patent, that the value of the patent is its enforceability in court. In anticipation of what potentially can happen in a court of law by a defendant, we suggest that not only a U.S. patent search be conducted, but a worldwide patent search is conducted for the purpose of anticipating what possibly might happen. When a patient goes to the doctor...
And you charge accordingly for that?
Well...
I presume.
Yes and no. The charges are another issue, Your Honor.
There are pre-filing searches that are done. There are post-filing searches. There are validity searches. And there are a whole scope of searches that can be done for patents and patent applications.
But this information wasn't provided.
The relationship of the client and the firm was at that particular time. If, in fact, the request was to file only in the U.S. and only U.S. art to be prior to search before filing, that's one aspect of it. But how does that impact patent law? I'm still not quite sure about the jurisdictional aspect of the search, causing it to be a patent law issue.
Because the legal malpractice involves a question of patent law and a question of due diligence in connection with the validity of a patent and the enforceability of a patent and the securing of that patent.
Well, is the question of patent law then whether a foreign patent can invalidate a U.S. patent?
Your Honor, this line of question is catching me a little bit off guard for the simple reason that we presumed that since the court accepted the appeal, that we were in the right court. I haven't really thought about that question and that issue. In reading the statutes, I personally read the statute as saying so long as there's even an iota of a patent somewhere in there, it deserves to be in this court.
The statute doesn't say remotely, which you mentioned three times earlier, and it doesn't say iota either. The operative language in the statute is substantial question of patent law. That's why the three of us keep asking you, well, what is the patent law question that has to be answered to resolve this appeal? And I'm still not sure we have your answer. Is it the interpretation of 102A? Is that the question of patent law?
No, no. The issue here in this case for the dismissal is when did the statute of limitations actually start?
That's a state law question.
I understand, Your Honor.
That's not a question of patent law.
I agree. I understand and I agree.
Now, the Second Circuit didn't send the case here. You dismissed there and refiled here by
stipulation. By stipulation, yes.
But then we're not barred, as I understand the ping pong rule, from sending it to the Second Circuit if we conclude that we don't have jurisdiction because we can't identify a substantial question of patent law that's central to resolving the appeal. That's correct, isn't it? We can send it back. All right, well, why don't you address this? Why don't you assume for a minute that we ultimately may conclude we do have jurisdiction. Then how do you get us to reverse the judgment in this case?
We respectfully submit, Your Honor, that Mr. Benjes would not have been able to truthfully and properly allege with the specificity that is required by a new case that issued by the Supreme Court.
But even if we assume he didn't know and couldn't have known within 3 years, New York law seems to be clear that the date of discovery of the problem doesn't count. It's the date of the bad act that starts the statute of money.
Your Honor, it's not a question of discovery. The statute specifically says that a cause of action accrues when every single one of the elements of that cause of action can be properly pled. In the process of all the arguments that have taken place, what has happened is that the court has completely ignored a very important element in the cause of action. The Federal District Court, the law of the Southern District of New York, and the appellees, which
is... Do you have any New York case that holds that a cause of action for legal malpractice does not accrue until the plaintiff is able to demonstrate precisely the total damages he or she is claiming?
No, I do not have a case, and I couldn't find one. All the cases that I found were accounted.
But there are cases out there saying that a cause of action for legal malpractice accrues when the legal action is completed.
Not the legal action. When the legal malpractice cause of action, each and every one of the elements can be properly pled. McCoy stands for that proposition.
Well, let's look at the date when the patent issued in 2002.
I'm sorry?
The patent issued in 2002, didn't it?
I believe so.
At that point, certainly you could demonstrate at least two elements of damage that had accrued. One was the amount you pay the lawyers, and two was whatever expenses you incurred in getting the patent. If you had to make two trips from somewhere to see the examiner, that would be easy. So why haven't some damages at least accrued?
Your Honor, you can't get to the question of damages unless you can actually show a loss or injury. There was no injury at that moment. The plaintiff actually had a patent. He had a benefit. He was not liable for anything. In the case of Ashcroft...
Well, he was liable for the amount he agreed to pay the lawyers.
He had paid them. There was no liability. They were fully paid. That was not an issue. When we talk about liability, we're talking about an injury, something that I have to do to somebody else as a result of something that I caused that person. That's what we're talking about, liability or injury. The most important thing here is the third element in the tort, which is the breach of the duty caused a loss or an injury. The damages at that point were speculative because there was no injury and there was no loss. The time when an injury and loss actually occurred was during that litigation. That's when the injury occurred. That's when the loss occurred. By accepting what the court is proposing, the Federal District Court in the Southern District is proposing, what we're basically doing is we're taking the four elements of the cause of action and we're merging them into two. That a legal malpractice cause of action can be asserted the minute you can show a breach of duty. What happened to the injury and the loss in the process? The damages are speculative only to the extent because there is no identifiable injury or loss. And even assuming for one moment that Mr. Ben just went out and got a second and a third and a fourth opinion, that is simply an opinion. That's all it was. Again, dealing with an injury or loss, it's speculative. Under Ashcroft versus Iqbal, how would my client be able to submit enough facts before the court in 2002 or 2005 to plausibly plead a cause of action? How could he push it over and say, in fact, this is my injury, this is my loss? It was all speculation.
Is there any New York law on this question? You told me that you didn't have any New York case.
I do not.
Supported your position. Is there any New York law discussing this issue?
I wish there was, Your Honor, but I haven't been able to find it.
But as far as you know, there is no New York law.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is New York law applicable? Should we apply some other statute?
No, the statute of limitation is very clear that the ones that are cited in our briefs, those are the statute of limitations that actually apply.
And it's all New York state law?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's 3 years?
Yes, Your Honor. From the date of accrual, and the definition of accrual is laid out in the court.
No.
When do you say it accrued?
December of 2007. That's when the injury and the loss ceased.
Is that when the patent was invalidated?
Yes, Your Honor.
What was it at that point? What happened at that point that you say first accrued the cause of action?
I'm sorry?
What was it that accrued the cause of action in 2007? Was it this expert report?
It was the expert report together with the judge's opinion that in fact this was a patent that was invalid and unenforceable.
Did the judge issue a final opinion?
No, Your Honor. It was simply in discussions on the record.
So this is all opinion on this?
Yes.
And what happened to the case settled?
Yes.
So there's no judgment that the patent is invalid?
No, Your Honor. However, think about it. The damages going forward, every time my client seeks to assert this patent, during discovery, this information is all going to come out.
But there is no judgment invalidating the patent. So
no,
the patent is still presumptively valid.
Yes, sir.
What did the judge say about the validity of the patent?
Among other things, that it was invalid and that my client should really take the settlement.
All right, we'll let you have the rebuttal time you sought to preserve, and we'll hear from Mr. Davis. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
The plaintiff here alleges that the allegedly negligent legal advice was given in 2000, and the plaintiff doesn't deny that the latest that defendants continue to represent him was at the time the patent was issued in September of 2002. The plaintiff also doesn't deny that there's a 3-year statute of limitations for non-medical malpractice in New York, and that there's no discovery rule. Yet it's a discovery rule by another name that's precisely what plaintiff has been advocating before the district court and continues to advocate before this court.
Now, you've heard us discuss the jurisdictional issue.
Yes, sir.
Whether or not this case should be here or the Second Circuit. On what ground would you establish jurisdiction before the Federal Circuit?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, it's plaintiff's, it's appellant's appeal. Filed this appeal in this court. We don't have a cross appeal of any kind. So it is.
Well, I understand they filed in the Second Circuit first.
Apparently they did, and apparently after consultations, which did not involve me personally, and since it's not a part of today's record, I'm not as aware of all the details, and I was not the attorney involved. But accepting what was represented to the court a few moments ago, that there were consultations with other lawyers from my firm, and it was agreed that it could be filed here in this court. I've looked at the statute, and what I can only presume, Your Honor, is that where the statute says, if the jurisdiction of the lower court was based in whole or in part on the patent laws, the stipulation or the agreement must have been reached in light of the fact that if this motion to dismiss had not been granted below, and the case were to go to trial, that patent issues or search issues would have been part of the trial and the trial record, and therefore, since it was in whole or in part, the jurisdiction below was in whole or in part related to the patent statutes, that this statute, 1295, triggered the jurisdiction of this court. That is apparently, I can presume, to be the case.
Couldn't this case have been decided on the merits without any determination of any question of patent law? Suppose your firm could establish that the search it made in this case was accepted as an appropriate search in any patent case. That has nothing to do with interpreting or applying any provision of the patent laws. That involves what the duties of a lawyer are. And if you could establish that, I take it you would prevail on the merits of this case.
I believe you're right, Your Honor.
And therefore, I wonder how you find that there is a question of patent law that is necessary for the plaintiff to prevail.
I understand your point, Your Honor. Two things. First, just as a minor point, and I know it's come up in the prior discussion before plaintiff's counsel, there's been some discussion about the search that was done by our firm. It is not a part of this record, which is purely on the motion to dismiss based on statute of limitations grounds. So it is not something that's currently before this court. But there was, the allegation was that either there was no search or that the search was done improperly. And if the record were ever to be developed, if this court did not affirm and there were a trial, it would emerge that actually plaintiff instructed that there be no search, so there was no search. To answer Your Honor's procedural question, I believe that's right, that there are a number of different ways that that the case could have moved if the motion to dismiss on statute of limitations grounds had not been granted, that one could postulate would not have involved the patent laws at all, as Your Honor correctly stated. I suppose one could equally postulate that it could have gone in other ways in which patent laws might have been implicated, and I can only suppose that it was that possibility that was at issue when the plaintiff filed the appeal in this court and our firm apparently agreed to that.
What's your answer to the argument of opposing counsel that rather than discovering the wrongdoing, the important thing here is when injury first occurred? She seems to trace the moment of injury to when the district judge said informally, but on the record, that he doubted the validity of the patent.
Yes, sir.
And that really isn't a discovery rule, because the discovery would have to do with the prosecution conduct of the lawyer. That really does. Her point seems to speak to the time of injury, and she puts it at when Rakoff said, "This patent looks like a lemon to me," or whatever he says. What's your response to that?
Judge Michel, I believe what plaintiff's position is here is that, as I believe was also mentioned previously, that it was when an expert report emerged in a different litigation in December of 2007 that said there was prior art, that it was at that moment in time, that's the moment in time they pin as the moment when they, quote, came to understand for the first time.
Okay, but you're saying that's just a discovery argument, and under New York law, the time of discovery isn't helpful except in medical malpractice, so not relevant here. But she seems to be saying, whether it's Rakoff's comment or the expert report, either way, that it's not a matter of that's when we first discovered the malpractice. She's saying that's the first time that we were in fact injured.
Your Honor, I believe that's been addressed sufficiently by New York law. New York law has directly addressed the issue of when does injury occur for purposes of accrual of a legal malpractice action. And what the Court of Appeals, the highest court in New York, has said on several different occasions, both in McCoy and Ackerman cases cited in the appellant's brief, is that the injury occurs at the time the legal malpractice, at the time the allegedly negligent advice is given. That is the moment in time. And indeed, in both cases, the facts almost directly parallel with the kind of argument that appellant is making here. In the Ackerman case, which was a legal malpractice case, the plaintiff tried to argue that, gee, it doesn't accrue until the IRS assesses me and I find out that I actually owe these taxes. Court said no, that's not when it accrues. It accrues at the time the lawyer gave you the allegedly negligent legal advice.
Have no courts ever addressed this precise question, that is, whether a claim for legal malpractice can be said to accrue at a time when no damages were ascertained? Her claim, and she said she was unable, as I understood, she said she was unable to find any.
I believe, Your Honor, that both Ackerman and McCoy addressed the question of whether or not the argument of having only speculative or not yet actual damages is sufficient to put off the time of accrual of a legal malpractice
action. And you think it rejected that?
And the court, I think, very clearly in both cases, both in the situation involving the IRS tax assessment situation, where it was legal advice relating to taxation, as well as in the McCoy case, a more recent Court of Appeals case, where the issue was advice that had been given with respect and acts that had been given with done with respect to it was a wife plaintiff in a divorce action, whether or not the lawyer had properly given advice and made filings concerning the husband's pre-retirement death benefits. And she tried to argue that, gee, I don't know whether or not I will have non-speculative actual damages until the husband dies and we see what happens. Well, the court addressed that exact question in its opinion and said, no, we can't have a inchoate statute of limitations hanging out there in the ether that way. It's got to be at the time the actual legal act, the legal malpractice, the bad advice or the bad legal services were rendered, that's the time injury occurs, that's the time when the plaintiff could begin to rely on it, and that's when we start the clock running.
But that seems to be rather unusual, though, doesn't it? Because if you don't know that the advice that you're receiving is going to injure you for 7 to 10 years, like a license for a particular business transaction that is declared void in 7 to 10 years and was based upon legal advice which was erroneous, does that mean that your statute of limitations will prevent you from recovering any damages at that point? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, I have two responses, Your Honor. First is, I would respectfully refer you to Judge Rakoff's ruling in this case, where he makes the point, and I believe he even mentioned something along those lines, that he might not be happy with some of the implications of this statute and the case laws as the Court of Appeals has issued the case law, but that is in fact the law, and whether those are the policy implications or not, he was obliged to enforce it. And Your Honor, we would believe that just like in almost any situation involving statute of limitations, when you're talking about the overall policy implications and potential ramifications, one can make policy arguments on both sides. The arguments that the Supreme Court has recently made with respect to repose and the need for finality on the one hand versus, on the other hand, fairness to the individual plaintiffs.
But let's
talk about the litigation.
Yes, Your Honor.
But if we consider the practical circumstance of all patent cases, if I'm a patent prosecuting attorney, and Arthur Gallarza is the inventor, and he comes to me, and I take the case, and I file an application on his behalf, and let's assume that all of my analysis and everything that I wrote up in the application is grotesquely incompetent. Under the average time in examination, the statute of limitations in New York will have run before the patent even issued. So there'll be no chance for somebody to enforce it and then find out that the patent was invalid because I totally bungled every single thing I did in the prosecution. It's likely to be a decade later before there'll be any invalidity issue raised in a court. So in every patent case, then, malpractice, at least in New York, totally off the table because it will never be within 3 years of when the prosecution misconduct by the attorney occurs.
Your Honor, in this case, we've acknowledged for purposes of this appeal and for purposes of this motion that under New York's continuous representation doctrine, you would even extend the time all the way through the issuance of the patent, which was in September of 2002, which was about 2 years and two or three months after the application was filed. So you have that continuous representation doctrine, which in many ways is there to address some of the precise issues that Your Honor just mentioned. So after the application, after the patent was issued,
because you can make a good point about issuance date versus advice date. That's a very fair point, and nicely put. But on the other hand, the patents are good for 20 years. Now suppose that the inventor Gallarza's patent issues, and nobody's infringing it for 10 years. And then suddenly somebody makes an infringing product, and so he goes off to assert his patent, files an infringing suit, and then it turns out the patent's blatantly invalid because everything prosecuting attorney Michelle did was totally incompetent. But now we're 10 years from issuance, but only halfway through the life of the patent, and malpractice is out the window in every such case.
Your Honor, if there is in fact a situation where the period of time, 3 years, has passed after the claim has accrued and injury has occurred, as both the statute and the Court of Appeals of the State of New York have ruled that they accrue, then that well could happen and that would be the implication. I can make the arguments, and I'm sure this panel is well aware of them and doesn't need to hear them from me, on the other side in favor of statutes of limitations
Look at trial delay time. Suppose that in the same hypothetical I gave you before, the suit is filed on day one. The day after the patent issues, the suit is filed. The suit is going to take 3 years to get tried, if not more. So if issuance date is a magic date to start the 3-year statute of limitations on malpractice running, by the time the district court gets around to holding the patent that I procured for Gallarza invalid, it's already too late.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure that that would necessarily be the case either, because by that time, you would have accrual, you would have filed your complaint, you would then have litigation. I presume that once you have an active litigation that you've already filed your complaint and your statute, you're within your statute. As long as you file your damages claim against the lawyers within that 3 years.
No, I'm talking about the infringement case.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Filed the next day after the patent issues. But because the adjudication times are so slow, the malpractice 3-year statute of limitations in almost every case will already have run before the district court in the infringement case has the opportunity to rule on validity. And therefore, when the district court finally finds the patent invalid, and it's becomes clear that it was all my fault, it's already too late. The statute is run.
Well, it's an interesting point, Your Honor. I suppose what I would do if I represented such a plaintiff and I was in the middle of that litigation and it was taking 3 years, I suppose I might be guided by the very clear New York Court of Appeals cases that I just cited to you and several others. I would file an action and I would claim that I've been injured, that I've already incurred legal fees, that I've already incurred patent fees, marketing fees, and expenses, all fees which Judge Friedman correctly said already in this record that this particular plaintiff already incurred. I have a cause of action, and if I haven't yet...
But based on what? That the answer says the patent is invalid? So just because the defendant in the infringement action asserts in an answer the patent is invalid, that crystallizes the injury to the patent owner?
Again, Your Honor, I think the two actions are somewhat separate. In order to prove my legal malpractice, I don't think it's the exact same standard as what the infringement action would have to find in order to find my patent invalid. If I found that the lawyer, even if I ultimately prevailed, for example, in the patent action on the infringement case, I could still potentially prove that my lawyers acted way less than the standards of reasonable care and prevail in my malpractice action, and I might still have some damages.
What if it's the expert report at the end of discovery for the accused infringer that contains an assertion of invalidity of the patent? If we use that, that still might be 3 years plus after the filing of the lawsuit that's filed the day after the patent issued.
All those events which could trigger additional damages and or additional knowledge in the mind of the plaintiff that he either has a better cause of action, a stronger cause of action, or even a possible cause of action, could all happen well outside the 3-year statute of limitations. That is the case, Your Honor.
And I understand your claim. The patentee would file a patent against his lawyer while he has an infringement action against somebody else. And that would be an oxymoron in his part. He'd have to admit that his patent is invalid at that point.
Well, I'm not sure. There wouldn't be a way to say that I've got this case pending and I'm prosecuting that case, but because I have a 3-year statute of limitations that the Court of Appeals of New York has said I have to live with, then I have to do what I have to do to protect my own rights.
Well, your answer to the problems to which the other members of the panel have just been alluding is that if in fact the New York 3-year statute and the way it's been interpreted causes serious problems with respect to claims of legal malpractice in patent litigation and only in patent litigation, then it's up to the New York legislature to change the law if it wants to create an exception or a different standard for patent cases. But we are bound here in this court by the interpretations of the New York courts of New York law.
Precisely.
Anything further?
If I could just address the final point that Judge Friedman made early on. In addition to making the point that the Court of Appeals in New York has ruled on this issue, that the legislature has passed the relevant statute and the Court of Appeals has issued the case law that we're now bound and guided by, we don't even have to reach the issue of whether or not that law applies in New York, and that's because here, even under plaintiffs' and appellants' own record and their own complaint, they have non-speculative actual damages as of the time of September 2002, and they list them in their complaint, paragraphs 16, 19, and 20, page 8 of the joint appendix. Patent costs, manufacturing costs, marketing costs, selling costs, they call them investments, but whether they call them investments or damages or costs or anything else, these are clearly non-speculative actual damages that they already had in September of 2002. So even under plaintiff's own theory, which of course we do not accept and we've been discussing up to this point, but even under plaintiff's own theory, they would have had a cause of action that they could have brought back then.
The less money, perhaps, than they're now seeking, but still definite amounts.
Precisely.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there a rebuttal time for you, Mr. Perry Phillips?
Mm-hmm.
to the very last point about the damages being ascertained, there are four elements for the accrual of a legal malpractice lawsuit that must be asserted: duty, breach of duty, injury, and damages. The damages are clearly distinct from the injury. It is our position, Your Honors, today, that there was no way that we would have been able to assert sufficient facts in connection with the third element of injury until December 2007. So that even if, in fact, there was a number that we could come up with in connection with damages, that would have been speculative in the sense that, what are you coming here asking for it? You haven't been injured. Nothing has happened to you. That injury didn't occur until December 2007. Going back to Your Honor's position about whether there is any case law in the state of New York for legal malpractice, the question of legal malpractice, not accounting malpractice. As we stand here today, neither I nor appellees have been able to supply any cases in the state of New York that specifically address when a cause of action for legal malpractice accrues. The cases that are before this court are all accounting cases. Those cases do stand for the proposition of when the statute of limitations begins to run and the fact that the cause of action needs to accrue. Those cases are distinguishable from the case here before this court today in that in those cases, the injury was ascertainable at the time that the breach of duty actually occurred.
The injury or the damage?
The injury. The injury was ascertainable. The court is very, very clear.
The same thing true here. The injury occurred, under your theory, when the patent issued because the patent shouldn't have issued. Because the patent was invalid due to the inadequate search.
Because there was no damage in it, a loss to my client. In fact, my client is better off when it got the patent in his head than before he had the patent. Now he has the right in the eyes of the law to prevent others from making, using, or selling his invention. He wasn't damaged. Injury or loss is to the damage of personal property. That's how Black's Dictionary actually defines it. There is no loss. He had a patent. The patent, in his mind, was enforceable. There was no injury until December of 2007, and that's what distinguishes this case from the accounting cases that have been submitted in support of our position.
The problem I have with that is you said there was no injury until 2007. It's a commonplace in patent litigation that the accused infringer discovers prior art that the plaintiff had not discovered and that there had not been brought to the attention of the patent office. The fact that an expert came up and said, I've discovered two pieces of prior art that I think invalidate the patent, doesn't mean that that's when the injury, the damages occurred, because could have been, I don't know anything about it. In many cases, what happens is the answer is those two pieces of prior art are distinguishable. They don't invalidate the patent.
Your Honor, let's put it back into perspective in terms of procedure. We drafted a complaint. We brought it to the court. The court basically dismissed it on the basis of the statute of limitations. The implication was, when he did that, when Judge Rakoff did that, was that I could have drafted exactly the same complaint with the same level of specificity back in 2002 or 2005. Under the Ashcroft versus Iqbal Supreme Court case, which says that I need to allege sufficient facts so that my cause of action is not possible or likely, as my adversary has argued, but rather that it is plausible. The court says it has to push the case over the line so that the claim is much more rather to be rather than not to be. That's the implication that Judge Rakoff is saying. My position is, because I'm the one who drafted the complaint, that there is no way I could have drafted a complaint in 2005 without being speculative about the injury. There was no injury. The argument that would have come back was that the patent.
Why couldn't you hired an opinion counsel to give you an opinion on the validity of the patent as soon as the patent had issued? And if the expert opined that was almost certain the patent was invalid, then why isn't that enough right then and there to prove injury?
Because for every expert that I could hire at that point without some sort of court imprimatur of validity, as happened before Judge Borenstein, incidentally, it was a different case, it wasn't before Judge Rahoff, without some sort of imprimatur of validity from the court that my position of invalidity of the patent, for every expert that I could hire that says the patent is invalid, there's an expert that says that it's invalid. So where do we draw the line?
Your burden of proof that the patent would be invalid at that particular juncture, would it not? So if you believe that the patent validity is a question, you raise it at that point, you get your experts, and then you proceed to file your action. It's your burden to prove it.
That was exactly the argument that I made before Judge Rakoff. I posited that if, in fact, we take that position, now you have a patent holder who has a patent, who's overjoyed, who thinks he has a monopoly, who can do all these things. And now what you're saying is, oh, well, because the New York State law is this way, you, patent holder, have the burden to go in and hire an expert, incur additional costs. Your Honor pointed out how expensive it is to do a full-blown patent search. To do an additional search to determine whether the patent is invalid and unenforceable. That is extremely difficult on the patent holder after he has incurred $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 in costs to get the patent both domestically and internationally. It is a burden that is truly prejudicial to the patent holder and may very well stifle creativity and invention, because if I, as the patent holder, think, okay, so what good is it? I hired this patent attorney, now I'm going to go hire the other one to get additional opinions. You have to draw the line somewhere as to where the patent holder has to work.
You have to draw the line somewhere on time. Lots of extra time. We thank you both for a very forceful and clear argument. We'll take the appeal under advisement, and the court will now take a brief recess.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All rise.